From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A triumphant and defiant President Trump spoke for more than an hour before hundreds of supporters in the White House East Room today, basking in his acquittal in the Senate impeachment trial yesterday. Trump will always be impeached or charged by the democratically controlled House, but much as Bill Clinton, who was also acquitted, he will remain impeached. But Trump called his impeachment evil and corrupt, called Democrats vicious people, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi a horrible person, and he reprised his attacks on Robert Mueller, the FBI, and political enemies he referred to as liars, leakers, or sleazebags. Here's how he began the hour.
And this is really not a news conference. It's not a speech. It's not anything. It's just we're sort of, it's a celebration because we have something that just worked out. I mean, it worked out. We went through hell unfairly, did nothing wrong. Did nothing wrong.
Let's bring in Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for NPR. Franco, it was quite an hour. President Trump's ardent supporters surely cheering through all of it. What's your take for those who didn't get to hear this whole hour?
Well, it was like, you know, it was a big celebration. You know, President Trump walked down the hall of the White House as the Marine Corps band played Hail to the Chief. You know, the White House kind of billed this as a kind of victory lap, and they really unrolled all the spectacle that the White House has to offer.
Well, and he kind of went off on all different kinds of tangents. Let's hear as much as we can. He praised many of the Republicans, different lawmakers from across the country, made them stand, praised his legal team. He also praised Representative Steve Scalise, who we remember was shot in 2017 during a congressional baseball practice, just a terrible event. President Trump described it in detail while Scalise was sitting in the crowd and then went on. Let's listen.
This guy has the rifle and he's hitting people, and he was going to move up, and there was no out. I mean, if he would have been able to move up, there was no way to get out. The entrance was a single entrance way on the other side where he was. So everyone went into the dugout, ran into the dugout. But Steve was really hit badly in the stomach and with a bullet that rips you apart.
You know, Franco, this was a terrible event in 2017, but it did seem like a complete left turn on a day when the president was supposed to be reflecting on his impeachment trial.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that President Trump, you know, he does. You know, he singled out like his friends and supporters, and he kind of tells stories about each one. He did he told a story about Senator Grassley as well. In this case, he was talking about Scalise. And this is a story he has told several times at rallies. Almost any time that Scalise is in the room and he jokes that, like today, he joked that Scalise is looking better now than he did beforehand. And he also talks about how Melania Trump wouldn't have been so sad as Scalise's wife. It's a real kind of camaraderie type, feeling that he gives. It's just a tone that President Trump kind of brings to these things that, you know, we're probably not as used to with previous presidents.
Well,
for sure.
At points, it did feel as if he maybe forgot, or maybe forgot like a fox, right, that he was being broadcast across the country. It felt like you were at a closed-door donor dinner. As we said, he praised people who supported him. Went after Senator Mitt Romney, the only Republican to vote against acquittal for conviction. And he did kind of both in this one cut. Let's listen.
At the beginning, he knew we were right, Mike. And I appreciate it very much. You're just fantastic. And say hello to the people of Utah and tell them, I'm sorry about Mitt Romney. I'm sorry.
President, okay. They're addressing Utah's other senator, Republican Mike Lee. But one wonders, what happens to people like Lamar Alexander, who did not vote to convict the president, but said the Democrats made their case? Alan Dershowitz, one of the president's lawyers, said what the president did was wrong. It looked today as if what the president was going for was complete vindication.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something, a line that the president has maintained the whole time. He said it again today, that he did nothing wrong, that the call was perfect. But as you point out, there's plenty of people, including in the Republican Party, who feel that what he did was wrong. Mitt Romney was the one who was willing to vote against the president and vote to have him removed. others like Lamar Alexander, as you pointed out, as well as Lisa Murkowski, they also felt that what the president did was wrong, but just simply not an impeachable offense.
And just lastly, we know that Bill Clinton apologized after his impeachment trial. He was also cleared, as we said, or not convicted. When President Trump apologized today, it was to his family for the evil people who put them through this. There will be no apology from this president.
You know, President Trump is not someone who apologizes. He did apologize, as you point, for his family. And look, even when his supporters before apologized for it or talked about how they didn't appreciate his language, he himself said that's a fool's errand and everything he did was perfect.
And Piers Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get the view of Shermichael Singleton, a Republican political consultant who worked on Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. Welcome to Here Now.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for being here. Well, I want to get right into the events of yesterday and today, but I'm thinking about the past. So President Clinton famously apologized after he was acquitted. This, of course, is a very different circumstance and a very different president. But are you surprised at all that Trump is going on the offense?
No, I am not surprised. A long time ago, when I worked on the Romney campaign, believe this or not, one of my bosses at the time told me, as long as you're on the offense or offensive in politics, you're winning. And if you think about that notion in totality as it pertains to President Trump, every scandal, everything that should have impacted or would have impacted a traditional politician seems to not stick with him. And I would argue it is in part because of his ability to always be on the offense. We're always chasing him instead of him chasing us. And so I'm not surprised that the president is attacking individuals that he believes have acted in a manner that isn't in his interest.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Mitt Romney. He spoke yesterday before casting his vote to convict the president on abuse of power.
I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong.
You mentioned you work for Mitt Romney, and you've also said you respect his decision to vote to convict President Trump on abuse of power. Tell us more.
I do. I believe you have to respect a person if you believe they have arrived to a conclusion based upon what they perceive as the truth, based upon whatever ideals and principles that they may hold to be of importance. And I don't think it's proper to convict Senator Romney for those things, even if you may disagree with the position that he has taken. I think it's honorable and noble for him to take a position that is obviously disparate from the rest of the Republican Party. The president has 94% approval ratings. Obviously, Senator Romney had to make
this approval rating with his Republican base, you mean?
Correct, correct. Not only within the base, but also with elected officials, as we saw with the vote, right? The final tally of the vote. And so I think for Republicans, it's important for us to understand, to accept, and to recognize that you are going to have ideological differences. And I don't think you should shun individuals for maintaining and standing by their deeply held convictions. I think that's a noble thing.
Okay, so you think it's noble, you think it's honorable, but I just want to talk this through a little bit. So President Trump's son, Don Jr., feels very differently from what you're saying. He tweeted, quote, "Mitt Romney is forever bitter that he will never be POTUS. He was too weak to beat the Democrats then, so he's joining them now. He's now officially a member of the resistance and should be expelled from the GOP. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he was surprised and disappointed by Romney's decisions. But he does not exactly agree with this idea of expulsion. I mean, Shermichael, this brings up a bigger point about the senators possibly acting in fear during this whole process because they're fearful of the consequences. I mean, is it healthy for a party to silence all of its critics?
I don't think it is. And that's where it becomes sort of complicated. And by that, I mean elected officials are elected by a constituent base that supports them. And the expectation is that those leaders act in a manner that is consistent with the beliefs of the individuals who voted for them. Do you risk those individuals being replaced by losing their elections by individuals who actually do believe and view the world the way the president does? Which of the two are more dangerous? And I think that's a question that we all have to ask ourselves.
Do you think that's going to make it harder for Republican moderates to get reelected? I'm thinking about Maine Senator Susan Collins.
You know, I think so, but I would argue most of them will likely maintain their seats. And here's why I say that. I would imagine Republicans in the Senate, led by the majority leader, have looked at a lot of internal data in those specific vulnerable states like Joni Ernst and Susan Collins and others to assure if they vote in a manner that is favorable to the president, yes, the race may be difficult, but we still should be able to win against the likely opponent of those individuals in their respective states.
That's Republican political consultant Shermichael Singleton. Shermichael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Women in America have long vied for the highest political office, the presidency. This week on Throughline, how things have changed and not for female presidential candidates throughout American history. Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time to understand the present.
It's Here and Now. The federal government reports that more than 27 million Americans were unable to obtain health insurance in 2018, and one reason, state restrictions on Medicaid. That has some people crossing state lines to get the care they need. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez-Valdivia reports.
On a chilly afternoon, Terry Cox has come to Mountain View, Missouri to see a dentist. He's waiting on a bench outside a converted rectory.
You can get a tooth check and see what they got to do to it. Maybe get them all out.
The 56-year-old works in northern Arkansas and drove an hour and a half to the Good Samaritan Care Clinic. Trucks hauling timber out of the Ozarks fly by on Route 60, which runs right through the town of 2700. The clinic sits next to the First Baptist Church, which donated the building. It is only open once a week, but the big draw for Cox, it's free.
A big relief. Yeah, compared to a big bill, you know, which I got a lot of them, but it's hard, and it's good to know and thank God that they got places like this, you know, because it helps out the poor people, you know, it really does.
Any additional first-time patients?
Sorry.
Cox is not alone. Around 5 p.m., the door opens and dozens of patients file into the waiting room where they're given forms to fill out before treatment starts at 7. The clinic will see everyone who's in the waiting room at that time, usually from 35 to 50 patients.
We see a lot of middle-aged men and women who have gone without care for a long time.
Sherry Noble is the clinic's administrator and only full-time staffer. She coordinates volunteers, often doctors and nurses, who drive some 100 miles from Springfield after working full days at their own practices. Noble says they've seen a rising number of patients over the last couple of years. That coincides with another troubling trend. After nearly a decade of decline, the number of people uninsured in the U.S. is increasing. In 2017, more than 25 million people were uninsured. The following year, the number of uninsured increased by almost 2 million. Experts point to a number of factors, including President Trump's moves to undermine the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid restrictions are a factor as well.
We see that states are putting more red tape on families who are trying to enroll their children in Medicaid or making it harder for them to renew and extend their Medicaid coverage.
Joan Alker heads the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. The center reports that Missouri has seen one of the biggest increases in uninsured children in the country. The state is one of 14 that haven't expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
If Missouri were to expand Medicaid to parents and other adults, you'd see a welcome mat effect for the children, and that uninsured rate would come down.
Alker says free clinics like the one in Mountain View can be stopgaps for families without insurance, but they're not a sustainable resource for children. Dr. John Roberts, who founded the clinic 15 years ago, agrees.
In an ideal world,
we'd be put out of business, truly, you know, that there would be a health plan for everybody.
That's why he supports an initiative to get Medicaid expansion on the ballot in Missouri. The Republican-run legislature has rejected expansion there, but ballot initiatives have succeeded in other GOP-controlled states like Idaho and Utah.
For people to sign who are registered voters to have on their ballot.
Outside the clinic, a volunteer collects signatures to get the issue in front of voters in 2020. If the initiative succeeds, an estimated 200,000 people could be eligible for medical insurance. For Roberts, that could mean fewer patients at his clinic, something he welcomes.
They wouldn't have to wait in line for 3 or 4 hours on a Monday night in the heat of the summer and the cold of the winter of hoping that they will be seen.
Missouri Healthcare for All announced in January it had gathered more than 50% of the 172,000 signatures it needs. The deadline is May 3rd. For Here and Now, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Well, now to the state of Tabasco in Mexico, where a community is being built of 50 3D-printed homes. The U.S.-based nonprofit News Story has teamed up with the tech company Icon to build the world's first 3D-printed neighborhood in this rural community. It's part of a project working to end global homelessness. And we have the CEO and co-founder of News Story with us, Brett Hagler. He's in Atlanta, Georgia. And Brett, we've seen, you know, 3D printers, the idea of this three-dimensional model. Usually it means laying down layers of something, maybe, you know, pieces of wood to build a plank of wood through a computer design that builds it up. But how does that work with a whole house?
Yeah, well, at this point, I think everybody's familiar with 3D printing in general, but 3D printing houses is new. And so we are very fortunate to, with our partner Icon, have successfully printed the first few houses that real families in real need will live in. And that happened in December of 2019. And how it works, at least the way I like to describe it to my mom, is that you have a machine that's on an XY axis and a proprietary cement mix will ooze out of the nozzle. And it looks almost like soft serve ice cream. And we'll start at the bottom and then we will layer the home all the way to the top up until when you need to put the roof on. Those layers are, of course, coming from a software system and a CAD file that is able to print the best home possible for the family that will live.
Okay, so you're not just printing a shoe, which we've seen happen, layers of a shoe. You are printing, by printing, this is the computer that's figuring out how much of that ooze to spew out.
Correct.
You're making the whole house in one pass, not just some planks that are then nailed together on
that's
the house.
Right.
You're making the whole house.
Correct. It's the interior and the exterior walls, the whole structure that starts at the very bottom of the house. And it takes about 24 hours of print time to go from printing the very first layer to go all the way to the top of the house in about 24 hours of print time.
Yeah. We understand each home will have 2 bedrooms, a living room, kitchen, bath. You know, some would say this is wonderful. This is a way to quickly bring homes to areas that don't have them. But is there any hands-on? I mean, are there any jobs involved here?
Yeah, there are. And so it's a combination of using breakthrough technology and robotics and automation. At the same time, we also will have local workers that will add on doors, the roof. They'll come in and do the plumbing. We bring in the technology to make it faster, cheaper, and ultimately a better product, and then be able to have local labor to add on the other components that are necessary.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if one of those words is stronger, because they're made out of this cement that you guys have created.
Yes, we're very confident in saying that these will be the strongest homes in the whole town that we're building these homes in. This is something that will have a generational impact that can withstand definitely hurricanes, but also even a bigger disaster, which would be an earthquake.
Right.
They're seismic approved.
And this is, we understand, where the genesis for this came from, because New Story, your nonprofit, has built 2,500 homes in Bolivia, Haiti, Salvador, using traditional construction. But we understand the idea for this started after a trip to Haiti in 2010. This was the year of the magnitude 7.0 earthquake.
Yeah, the anniversary was January 10th,
right.
Just recently.
Well, and you couldn't find a charity to give to then. So is this a part of it, building homes, but also with that earthquake in mind?
Yeah, so I went on a personal trip to Haiti a couple years after the earthquake. I saw it first person. It really broke my heart. And then I tried to find other organizations that I could get really excited about and I could support. I couldn't find any organizations that, to me, from my opinion, were trying to really push the boundaries when it comes to technology and research and development. It just seemed like organizations were doing the same things that have always been done. And when we're facing a problem with the magnitude, the size, of the scale of the problem that we're trying to work on is so large, we believe that traditional methods and linear improvements are never going to make the dent that we need. And so therefore, we must take new actions and we must innovate, because that's the only way we believe that you're actually going to make quantum leaps in the number of families that we're able to help and partner with.
And these families, by the way, live on $3 a day in the town of Tabasco, Mexico. Mm-hmm. But the 3D printer that you use, it's called Vulcan 2.
That's right.
How expensive is that? I mean, could groups like Habitat for Humanity afford this instead of, you know, the people who come together to raise a roof? I mean, how expensive is it?
We're not saying the cost publicly today. I definitely would not say that it's quote, very expensive. I would say that when you're trying to do any new technology, in the beginning, the price is always higher, right? And the good news is that it's only going to go down from here. You know, the pricing is only going to get better when it comes to robotic construction. And the big idea here and why we partner with ICON so early in this evolution of trying to create 3D printed neighborhoods and communities is to really show the world what's possible, right? We want to be able to have a showcase area that says, we took this innovation, we took this this risk, and this is what's happened. And now we don't want to keep it for ourselves. That's actually the smallest minded thing we can do. The big idea is to open source and democratize and try to get this technology into the hands of other housing nonprofits and other governments that have agendas to solve very serious problems in their towns and their cities. Mm-hmm. And both News Story and ICON want to be able to serve as many other partners that we can that are working on such a critical issue, which is families living in poverty without access to safe shelter.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with that. That's Brett Hagler. He's CEO of News Story, a nonprofit that is building the world's first 3D-printed neighborhood in Tabasco, Mexico, with the company ICON. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Brett, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And we've reported here on how many rural hospitals in this country are struggling financially. Last year, 19 of them closed, the most in over a decade. In Pennsylvania, in a small borough north of Pittsburgh, one hospital recently joined those shuttering the doors. Sarah Bowden from member station WESA reports on what the loss of Elwood City Medical Center means for the town and the surrounding area.
I am walking around the perimeter of the now-closed Elwood City Medical Center. I'm at a set of automatic double doors. Of course, they're not opening.
Signs near all the entrances state that services are temporarily suspended and list the three nearest hospitals, each located roughly 30 to 40 minutes away. Towards the back of the facility, at an employee door, I see a woman leaving.
Hello. Can I help you? Do you work here?
Yeah.
Have they told you if the hospital's going to open up?
No.
In 2017, the medical center was purchased by the Florida-based AmeriCorps Health. But in late November, a broken CT scanner prompted the state to bar the facility from admitting new patients. 2 weeks after that, AmeriCorps closed the entire medical center. AmeriCorps told the Elwood City Ledger that it hoped to reopen the hospital in January. Then right before the new year, the company filed for bankruptcy. No one seems to know if or when the facility will reopen, and AmeriCorps isn't answering the phone. The situation has confused some patients of Dr. Beth Magnifico, whose primary care practice rents office space from the medical center in an adjacent building.
I think the community thought that the doors were truly padlocked, and we had to say, oh no, doors are open, we're here Monday through Friday.
But Magnifico says the hospital's closing presents challenges to her practice.
So I'm missing those x-ray services, MRI services, CT services that were at my fingertips for my patients. Now I don't have those.
No matter where you look, it's affecting everybody.
Patty Kuhn has a florist shop in downtown Elwood City.
They have to get new doctors. They have to go outside the area.
Kuhn arranges a bouquet of daisies and hydrangeas and says the medical center's closing was a shock.
But I feel like in the community of big hospitals, we were one of the few little ones left. But seems to be what's happening these days.
Populations across rural America are declining. That means hospitals have fewer patients and generate less revenue. Since 2005, 163 rural hospitals have closed. Rick Myers is the chief of the local fire department, which attends every 911 emergency in the borough. Myers says last year there were nearly 600 calls. Now that the hospital is closed, he says this puts a strain on first responders.
Somebody may now call 911 for something they may not have before because they could have just drove right up the street.
When Elwood City firefighters attend a medical call, it's their job to provide immediate care, but they can't drive anyone to the hospital. Instead, patients wait until an ambulance arrives. Without an ER in town, this might take hours.
Especially for somebody who needs a higher level of care immediately, that's a big difference.
In some instances, it's the difference between life and death. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Bowden.
As Democrats make their final pitches to voters in New Hampshire, we want to take a look at where candidates stand on one of the key issues in every presidential election, the economy. Joining us now is Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tanya. Good to be with you.
Thanks for being here. So I want to jump right into the candidates' proposals. One of the most talked about has been the idea of a wealth tax. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren at the December debate.
You know, I have proposed a 2-cent wealth tax. That is a tax for everybody who has more than $50 billion in assets. Your first $50 billion is free and clear. But your 50 billionth and first dollar, you got to pitch in 2 cents. And when you hit $1 billion, you got to pitch in a few pennies more.
Scott, what more can you tell us about her wealth tax and what her rationale is?
Well, she sees this as a way to raise a lot of money to bankroll some of her initiatives on health care, education, and the like, and also a way to address income inequality because the income tax, which we use now, doesn't really get at the pockets of the very wealthy. Her proposal is a 2% tax on wealth above $50 million. It sounded like she was saying $50 billion during the debate, $50 million, and then 3% on everything over $1 billion.
Okay. Where do the other top candidates come down on increasing taxes for these wealthier Americans?
Bernie Sanders has his own version of a wealth tax, which is similar to Elizabeth Warren's. They rely on some of the same advisors. But most of the other Democrats have not embraced a wealth tax. During one of the debates, Andrew Yang actually pointed out that a lot of European countries that tried a wealth tax ultimately gave up on it because these kind of taxes do tend to be somewhat difficult to administer. There's lots of avenues for rich people to evade the tax. And as a result, they don't necessarily raise as much money as the supporters hope. Yang himself favors a value-added tax, which is kind of a national sales tax. And most of the other Democrats endorse higher income taxes on top earners. Joe Biden, for example, would raise the top marginal tax rate back to where it was before the GOP tax cut at the end of 2017. That's about 40%. Pete Buttigieg would go higher, up to a top rate of around 50%. And Mike Bloomberg just came out with a tax plan that puts him sort of in the middle. He'd raise the top tax rate back to about 40% and then add a 5% surcharge on income over $5 million.
Let's talk about something else. Trade has also been an important issue. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders on CNN in August. He was asked if he would resort to tariffs if elected.
Yeah, of course. It is used in a rational way within the context of a broad, sensible trade policy. It is one tool that's available. What we need is you're looking at somebody, by the way, who helped lead the effort against permanent normal trade relations with China and NAFTA. because trade policies that we have had in the past have lost us millions of good-paying jobs.
Senator Sanders has said the president's way of using tariffs has been, quote, irrational and destabilizing, and yet he would use them. So, Scott, how would you describe his stance?
Well, as the senator himself described himself there, he's probably one of the more protectionist candidates in the Democratic field. He has long been skeptical of trade agreements like NAFTA. He's also opposed to the newly updated version of that agreement with Mexico and Canada, even after House Democrats succeeded in winning new protections for labor and the environment. Contrast that, for example, with Elizabeth Warren, who backs the updated NAFTA, now known as the USMCA, even though she's also not a real classic free trader.
Are there any other candidates that are differentiating themselves on trade?
You know, almost all the Democrats have said they would not rejoin the big Asia-Pacific trade deal that President Trump pulled the U.S. out of on one of his first days in office, even former Vice President Biden, who was vice president when that deal was negotiated.
That's right.
President Trump has really succeeded in kind of moving the dialogue on trade in this country in a more protectionist direction. Even though, it's interesting, voters who don't like the current president have actually grown more supportive of free trade in reaction to Donald Trump's protectionist measures. Hmm. One thing that does unite the Democrats is that most of them say in trying to deal with China's unfair trading practices, the U.S. should work with its allies. And that's sort of at odds with the president's approach, President Trump's approach. He has more or less taken on China all by himself, while in many cases alienating other countries by picking separate trade fights with them.
I want to talk about Pete Buttigieg, who's talked a lot about investing in rural America. Here he is talking about poverty in the December debate.
We've got to talk about poverty in this country. There is not one county in the United States of America where someone working full time at the minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment. In most places, not even a one-bedroom apartment. The biggest problem in our economy is simple. People are not getting paid enough. That is not the result of some mysterious cosmic force. It's the result of bad policy, and we've got to change it by raising wages and empowering workers.
Okay, he's talking about raising wages and empowering workers. Scott, can you tell us a little bit more about his plan?
He has a lot of plans, I guess many of them informed by his experience as the mayor of South Bend, his former mayor now. But he's called for more federal investment in education in high poverty areas. He's talked about boosting federal investment in infrastructure. He's also outlined what he calls his Douglas Plan, named in honor of Frederick Douglass, to address some of the systemic economic challenges facing African Americans. Of course, we've talked a lot about how Buttigieg has yet to gain any real traction with African Americans, and they are, of course, a key constituency in the Democratic primary process.
Yeah. I'm also wondering how much other candidates are also talking about poverty.
Well, you know, you heard Buttigieg talking there about how a minimum wage worker can't afford a two-bedroom apartment. There is widespread support among Democrats for boosting the minimum wage. The federal minimum has not actually increased in a decade. It's still stuck at $7.25 an hour. But in that decade, we have had dozens of states and cities that have boosted their minimum wages. And that is now one factor driving what President Trump described as a blue-collar boom in this country. When he used that phrase in his State of the Union speech on Tuesday when he noted that wages have actually been climbing faster for those at the bottom of the income ladder. One reason for that is that in much of the country now, there is either a state or a local minimum wage that's well above the federal minimum. Another factor, of course, helping to boost wages at the bottom of the ladder is the very low unemployment rate, which does give workers more bargaining power.
Let's hear from Vice President Joe Biden. He's focused on former President Obama's economic record throughout his campaign. Here he is at a campaign event in October in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Donald Trump inherited a strong economy from Barack and me. Things were beginning to really move. And just like everything else he's inherited, he's in the midst of squandering it. Squandering. We need to build an economy. We need to build an economy that, in fact, rewards work, not just wealth, reflects our values. And that's going to start, I'm going to start by reversing the Trump tax cuts for the super wealthy and corporations.
This is pretty interesting, Biden's economic message. I mean, he's very much focused on President Obama's record.
That's right, which he shares as Obama's right. running mate. So he calls it his own record as well. He is defending that and pointing out correctly that the economy was pretty good when the Obama-Biden team left office. Biden does have an affirmative economic program of his own, but it is certainly less ambitious than some of his Democratic rivals. It's also cheaper, which could appeal to some voters who worry about the big price tag on things like Medicare for All.
Yeah. When you look at the Democrats' message on the economy overall, do you think the strong economy and low unemployment rate, as you mentioned, those numbers that we're experiencing right now, make it harder for them to criticize President Trump on this specific issue? What do you see in the roadmap looking forward?
It is a difficult balancing act for the Democratic field because the U.S. economy is doing pretty well. Consumer confidence is strong. The Democratic candidates probably don't want to sound as if they're talking down the economy. At the same time, they do want to challenge President Trump and his claims of something like a great American comeback. As we said, in fact, the economy was pretty good when President Obama left office. The GDP growth last year was basically the same as it's been on average over the last decade. So this notion that there's been some tremendous turnaround under President Trump is probably a notion that Democrats want to challenge. The other thing they might do is take issue with some of the metrics. You know, when the president talks about the booming stock market, Democrats might want to remind Americans that stock ownership is very heavily concentrated among the wealthy. About 45% of Americans own no stock, and most Americans don't have a whole lot of their wealth tied up in the stock market. For them, things like medical bills and weekly paychecks are more important markers of how the economy is doing.
That's Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
They're back.
Baby Shark, baby shark, baby shark, baby shark.
But sharp ears may detect a slight difference because that was the live stage version of Baby Shark. Yes, you can now sing it with thousands of other parents, grandparents, toddlers. It's like everyone gets to be at Nationals Park when Gerardo Parra comes to bat and that's his walk-up song and everyone makes their arms like a shark. Baby Shark Live is coming to an American city near you. Either run in the opposite direction or to get tickets because they will sell out. Smart Study, the South Korean company behind the popular children's song, is now touring with Baby Shark and his friends across Canada and the U.S. Jonathan Linden is co-president of the production company Round Room Live. They've partnered with Smart Study to put on this concert tour. And Jonathan, you tell us you're not sick of Baby Shark yet. But it's just 18 words in a 2-minute video. How do you make it into a 75-minute show?
Well, I think the song's infectious, and it gives off sort of a vibe and a feel that everybody likes and makes everybody feel great. And you mentioned that Smart Study and Pinkfong are the parent company that control Baby Shark. And so together with them and their catalog, we created a concert experience for preschoolers and children, and it features a number of different songs, but obviously Baby Shark is the star of the show.
Yeah, the big payoff. And is there a problem with that? In fact, let's listen to a montage of some of the new songs that are in the show. There's Three Little Monkeys singing. There's Three Blue Penguins singing and tap dancing. Let's listen to a montage. Well, there's a whole kind of children's show circuit. Anyone who's been to any of these big arena shows for toddlers knows that it's just mayhem and frenzy and, you know, things, balloons, confetti falling from the ceiling and, you know, lots of excitement, almost like to pattern on a rock show.
Certainly, it's become a very popular area. And as you mentioned, concert touring, my partner and I came from a concert touring background where we worked at Live Nation and worked with bands like the Rolling Stones and Genesis. And so we saw a number of aspects that came out of that world. We've also worked on Broadway shows like Rock of Ages. And we saw a number of different aspects, both from the Broadway world and the concert touring world, that we thought would work well for the preschool consumers. And my partner and I both have young children, and so we've been to a lot of these types of shows as consumers. And so there was a number of components that we wanted to bring to Baby Shark Live that we thought would play well, and that it would play well almost like a concert experience, moving from song to song in a quick and fun way.
What is the – and the New York Times has written about this, I can't believe, you know, has gone into great depth, actually, a very long, intensive piece on the origins of Baby Shark. Some people say it was a camp song. Some say it's a modern version of oral folk tradition. You know, like Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Do you know where Baby Shark came from?
I think it is, as they say, a camp song that's been around for many years. But the version that Pinkfong and Smart Study created of Baby Shark is, I think, its own unique version. And the way they've sort of put the tune together, and inevitably it goes together with a video. And that video now has 4 billion views and is the fifth most watched video in the history of YouTube. And so I think there's a number of very clear components that Pinkfong and Smart Study brought to the old song Baby Shark that turned it into their own unique version. And it's that version that's really resonated with children. As you mentioned, the Washington Nationals and other examples where Baby Shark has really pierced into the mainstream and has wider appeal than just children in a lot of situations.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the 4 billion or so views. I think a billion of them were in homes that I've been in. What happens? Because we know there's versions of Baby Shark throughout the show. But what happens as you're building towards the moment when these kids are finally going to see what they've been seeing, you know, on their devices, what they're going to see it on stage? What happens?
One of the wonderful things about being at the Baby Shark show is, like a lot of shows and concerts, everybody's got a phone out. And the amazing thing is how many people are taking pictures of their children as opposed to taking pictures of the stage. And the reason they're doing that is there seems to be a lot of children who are just simply mesmerized, and their parents want to capture that moment where Baby Shark comes alive and it's right there in front of them rather than just listening to the song in their house.
I can't imagine the frenzy, what it would be like for 2 and 3 year olds. I know. To see Baby Shark on a stage.
It's a lot of fun. The room gets electric. I think we do a really nice job building up to it. There's a lot of fun and exciting songs, including songs that the children recognize. They start to work up towards the frenzy of the big payoff of hearing the extended version of Baby Shark, which they just simply can't wait for when it arrives.
Yeah, their heads explode. And yeah. I'm sure many have to be peeled off the ceiling for days to come. Jonathan Linden, co-president of the production company Round Room Live. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, Tonya Mosley, are you okay? I don't know if you had to listen to this.
You know, it's an earworm, and I'll be singing it on the way home today.
Yes,
I know it.
Yes, you will. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tonya Mosley. This is Here and Now.